From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. The Grammy Awards take place next week. On today's Fresh Air, we feature interviews with three of the artists who will receive Lifetime Achievement Awards this year. Country music star Merle Haggard, legendary guitarist Eric Clapton for his band Cream, and British rocker David Bowie. Also, we take a look at some TV shows that haven't been allowed to reach the end of their natural lives. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Next week at the Grammys, country music singer Merle Haggard will be one of the recipients of a Lifetime Achievement Award. On today's Fresh Air, we hear from Haggard, as well as two other recipients, Eric Clapton for the band Cream and David Bowie. Music critic Peter Guralnick has said about Merle Haggard, quote, "There is no one in contemporary popular music who has created a more impressive legacy or one that spans a wider variety of styles," unquote. Haggard's best-known songs include Mama Tried, The Bottle Let Me Down, Okie from Muskogee, and Today I Started Loving You Again. He was inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame in 1994. Last year, Haggard was on tour with Bob Dylan. 10 of Haggard's early albums from the 1960s and 70s have been remastered and will be reissued this month. As a young man, Merle Haggard was in and out of prison and hardly seemed destined for success. Those prison experiences are reflected in many of his songs. Before we hear a 1995 interview Terry Gross recorded with him, let's hear Haggard sing one of his best-known compositions, Mama Tried.
First thing I remember knowing was a lonesome whistle blowing and a youngin's dream of growing up to ride on a freight train leaving town, not knowing where I'm bound, and no one could change my mind but Mama tried. The one and only rebel child from a family meek and mild, my mama seemed to know what lay in store. Out of all my Sunday learning, towards the bad I kept on turning, till Mama couldn't hold me anymore. And I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried. Mama tried, Mama tried to raise me better, but her pleading I denied. That leaves only me to blame, 'cause Mama tried.
Merle Haggard, is this song autobiographical?
Well, it really is very, very close. At least there's some things we fudged on slightly to make it rhyme, but the majority of it, I'd say 97% of it's pretty accurate, I guess.
Your father died when you were 9, is that right?
9.
So right. Your mother had to raise you alone after that.
Yeah, and I was, to say the least, probably the most incorrigible child you could think of. I was already on the way to prison before I realized it, actually. I was really kind of a screw-up, and I really don't know why. I think it was mostly just out of boredom and lack of a father's attention, I think.
I think you were 14 when your mother put you in a juvenile home.
No, she didn't put me in a juvenile home. The authorities put me in there for truancy, for not going to school, and they gave me 6 months in like a road camp situation, and I ran off from there and stole a car, and. So then the next time I went back, it was for something serious. And then I spent the next 7 years running off from places. I think I escaped 17 times.
How would you escape from reform school and youth institutions?
Well, there was different institutions and different methods. There was some of them were minimum security, some were maximum security, and some of them were kid joints, and some of them were adult jailhouses. And I just didn't stay nowhere. I was just, I think Willie Sutton was my idol, if you don't know, you know. At the time, I was in the middle of becoming an outlaw and escaping from jail and escaping from places that they had me locked up in was part of the thing that I wanted to do.
So what was your most ingenious escape?
Probably the one that was the most ingenious was one that I didn't actually go on. I was San Quentin. I was all set to go with the only completely successful escape out of San Quentin, I think, in 21 years. But the people that gave me the chance to go were the same people that talked me out of it, because they felt like that I was just doing it for the sport of it, and then it was a very serious thing to the other fellow that was going, and they had a big judge's chamber sort of desk that they were building at the furniture factory in San Quentin, and I had a friend who was building a place for two guys to be transported out. That was before they had x-rays and things of that nature, and I could have gone, and I didn't go, and the guy that I went with wound up being executed in the gas chamber. He went out and held court in the street, killed a highway patrolman, and so it was really good that I didn't go.
Was that a real sobering experience for you?
Yeah, I've had a lot of those things in my life, and, you know, those are the sort of things that that a guy unknowingly, like myself, I guess I was gathering up meat for songs, you know. I don't know what I was doing. I really kind of was crazy as a kid, and then all of a sudden, you know, and while I was in San Quentin, I just... I one day understood that I saw the light, and I just didn't want to do that no more, and I realized what a mess I'd made out of my life, and I got out of there and stayed out of there. Never did go back, and went and apologized to all the people I'd wronged, and tried to pay back the people that I'd taken money from, borrowed money from, or whatever. And I think when I was 31 years old, I paid everybody back that I'd ever taken anything from, and including my mother.
What did you say to your mother when you changed your life around?
Well, it was just obvious. I don't think there was ever any time that anybody in my family was worried about me staying with this. It was just the way that, you know, some people grow up in the Army, and, you know, it's hard to be 18 years old. And, you know, they send 18-year-old boys to war because they don't know what to do with them. And I was one that I wound up going to prison rather than war. And instead of growing up in the middle of a battlefield with bullets flying around me, I grew up on the isolation ward, death row. And that's where the song Mama Tried gets close to being autobiographical.
You were on death row?
Yeah, I was. I got... caught for making beer. Making some beer up there, and I got too much of my own beer and got drunk in the yard and got arrested. And it's hard to get arrested in San Quentin, but I did. And they sent me to what was known as the Shelf, and the Shelf is a part of the North Block, which you share with the inmates on death row. And it's kind of like there's not too many more stops for you, actually, you know. And that was the, as you put it, sobering experience for me. I wound up with nothing to lay on except a Bible and an old concrete slab, and woke up from that drunk that I'd been on that day, I could hear some prisoners talking in the area next to me. In other words, there was a alleyway between the back of the cells, and I could hear people talking over there, and I recognized the guy as being Carol Chessman, a guy that they were fixing to execute. And I don't know, it was just something about the whole situation that I knew that if I ever got out of there... If I was lucky enough to get out, I made up my mind while I still had that hangover that I was all finished.
How were you lucky enough to get out?
Well, I went back down on the yard and went down and asked for the roughest job in the penitentiary, which was a textile mill, and went down and just started building my reputation, you know, just started running in reverse from what I'd been doing and started trying to build up a long line of good things to be proud of, and that's what I've been doing since then.
Back in the days when you were in prison, was music a big part of your life then? Were you singing, playing, writing songs?
Yeah. Yeah, I was already into doing that. I really didn't, believe that I sincerely had a future in it. I think I was just kind of like doing what I thought was probably a waste of time or a hobby at the very most, and maybe some extra money on the weekend sort of thing. But that's when I was in San Quentin. I still didn't really thoroughly realize that I had to do this the rest of my life and that it was going to be this successful for me and I was going to, you know, have all the things happen that have happened. I had no idea that you could never have convinced me of a minute amount of the success I've had. I would never have believed it.
Did your musical ability have anything to do with people noticing you in prison and thinking that you could make it when you got out? I mean, did that help you at all in the war?
Yeah, that was the basic reason, I think, that these friends of mine talked me out of going on that escape. I mean, they felt that I had talent, and they felt that I was just a ornery kid and could probably make something out of my life. And you know, believe it or not, in the penitentiary, just some pretty nice people and very unfortunate people. And they love to let somebody, so to speak, get up on their shoulders. You know, they like to boost somebody over the wall if they can. If they can't make it themselves, they, I think, sincerely love to see someone else make it.
Country music singer Merle Haggard speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 1995 interview with Merle Haggard. Next week, he'll receive a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammy ceremonies.
Tell us the story how you got your first guitar.
My first guitar?
Yeah. Or how you started to play guitar.
Well,
as it was.
I have an older brother named Lowell, and Lowell had a service station at the time, and there was a guy who came in wanted a couple of dollars worth of gas and didn't have no money, and he left a little Bronson, sort of a Stella Sears and Roebuck type guitar. It's collateral, and he never did come back after it. And that old guitar sat in the closet there for a couple of years. And finally, I think my mother showed me a couple of chords. My brother didn't know how to play, and my dad had passed away. He was a musician in the family. So Mama showed me C chord that Daddy had showed her, and she didn't know how to make C chord very good. But I took it from that, and I beat around on that old Bronson. I think it was a Bronson guitar.
I imagine when you first got the guitar, you were playing the songs that you heard on the radio. How did you start writing songs yourself?
Well, about the same time that I discovered Jimmy Rogers, I was about 12 years old, I discovered Hank Williams, and I remember seeing on the yellow MGM records there was the artist's name, and then there was another name underneath that artist. It was a small, very small letters, and it said composer, and I didn't know what a composer was. I asked my mother, I said, what does this mean? She said, I don't know, and she called the record store, and they told her, that's the writer, that's the guy that writes the songs. And it seemed to me that it was very important to have your name in both places there. I noticed that Hank Williams had a little extra clout because he wrote his own songs. Jimmy Rogers, the same thing, you know. And so I felt it was just as necessary to become a songwriter as it was to try to learn to play the guitar or it was certainly a tool that most people, I think, in the business would like to be a singer-songwriter if they could be, because it is in some way your retirement. You know, you can have a great career, and if you don't write songs or have a publishing company or something to lean back on when it's all over, it's a pretty hard drop back to reality, you know. And once you've learned to live under the conditions I've learned to live on, you better have yourself a publishing company or I'll have to go back to being an outlaw.
When you started writing songs, did you realize that you could write autobiographical songs from your own life, or did you think you had to copy other people's songs?
Well, I really didn't realize what method to take at first. I must have wrote maybe 1,500 songs that weren't any good, or at least I never kept them, and finally was with a lot of help and a lot of people who had written hit songs who I'd become friends with, such as Fuzzy Owen, who became my personal manager. It was a songwriter, and he helped me. He taught me how to write songs, and finally I wrote one that was worth keeping, and I think I've written about 300 keepers or so, maybe 400.
Do you remember the first one that you felt this is worth keeping?
Yeah, it was a sort of a rock and roll song, or a Elvis-type rock and roll thing. It was called If You Want to Be My Woman, and Glenn Campbell opened his shows with it for years, and I still do the song, and I wrote it when I was about 14.
Could you sing a couple of bars of it?
You like riding in the country in my Cadillac, and you keep, I keep pushing me back, something about didn't own the money that I earned, but you refused to give me something equal in return. Don't look at me like maybe you don't understand. If you want to be my woman, you know you got to let me be your man.
Now, during all the years that you were in and out of prisons and reform schools, did you ever think I can make a living with music?
No, I counted on extra money, as I was saying, you know, like, you know, maybe a hobby, you know, I figured I was going to have to have some other means of employment, you know, or support.
So what made you think, well, I can make a living out of this?
When I came out of the penitentiary, I went to work for my brother digging ditches and wiring houses. He had an electrical company, Hag Electric. And he was paying me $80 a week. This was 1960. And I was working 8 hours a day there. And I got me a little gig playing guitar 4 nights a week for $10 a night. There was a little radio show that we had to broadcast from this little nightclub called High Pockets. And it just all started from that. Some people that had, that was local stars around, heard me on this radio program and came down and offered me a better job in town. It wasn't just a matter of weeks till I was part of the main clique in Bakersfield, and it was hard to get in that clique. There was a lot of people like Buck Owens, and there was people that Bakersfield was some sort of a, I don't know, it was like country music artists found their way to Bakersfield and had their success out of there. I don't understand why, actually. It may be because migration that took place in the 30s or whatever. There was a lot of people that came out there from Oklahoma and Arkansas and Texas that had a lot of soul. And this thing we call country music kind of came out of those honky tonks, you know, and some of the same area that a lot of other things came out of.
Was it hard for you to adjust to success and stardom, having come from poverty and, you know, having lived in prison off and on for so many years? I think it's hard for a lot of people to adjust to that.
There's a thing that happens, like when you leave the penitentiary, when you've been there for 3 years, you have friends and you have a way of life and you have a routine and a a whole way of life that you just give up all of a sudden. One day you're there and next day you're not there, and you don't have any more friends from the outside because things went on when you left, and you can't find anybody there, and the people you left behind in prison are really your only friends. And there's a period of adjustment that took me about 120 days, I don't know, about 4 months. A couple of times I really wanted to go back, and it's really a weird sensation. It's the loneliest feeling in the world about the second night out of the penitentiary.
Merle Haggard, recorded in 1995. Next week, he'll receive a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys. 10 of his early albums will be re-released this month. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Did you ever steal a quarter when you was 10 years old? Ever wear a broke gown with a hole in the sole? Did you ever ride a freight train while running from the law? I've done it all, Lord, Lord, I've done it all. Did you ever spend a winter in a dirty jail? Did you ever buy a top coat at a rummage sale? Did you ever spend a Christmas inside detention hall? I've done it all, Lord, Lord, I've done it all.
Well, I pick my support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, available in stores and online at bn.com. From Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we hear from two other artists due to receive Lifetime Achievement Awards at the Grammys next week. British rocker David Bowie and Eric Clapton for his band Cream. Also, we take a look at some TV shows with unfortunately short lives.
They pulled in just behind the bridge. He lays her down. He frowns. Gee, my life's a funny thing. Am I still too young? He kissed the girl in there. She took his ring, took his babies. It took him minutes, took her nowhere. Heaven knows he'd have taken anything.
All night.
She wants a young American. She finds a slinky vagabond. He coughs as he passes a Ford Mustang. Heaven forbid she could take anything. But the freak and his title for nothing. This is a step and cuts his hand. Showing nothing, it swoops like a song. She cries, where have all Papa's heroes gone?
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, filling in for Terry Gross. Today we're listening back to Terry's interviews with some of the influential musicians who will be noted for lifetime achievement at next week's Grammy Awards. In a few minutes, we'll hear from David Bowie. Also being honored next week, the group Cream, with Ginger Baker on drums, Jack Bruce on bass, and one of the first musicians to be called a guitar god, Eric Clapton. Terry spoke with Eric Clapton in 1989. In the 60s, Clapton led the British blues revival as a member of the Yardbirds, John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, and Cream. In the 70s, Clapton's slow hand played Layla and other classics in yet another influential group, Derek and the Dominoes. Since then, his solo recordings have been enormously popular. In 1993, he won 6 Grammys for Unplugged, and jump-started a revival of acoustic live recordings by modern pop stars. Last year, Cream reunited for a tour and released a CD and DVD of its performance at Royal Albert Hall. Before we hear Terry's interview with Eric Clapton, let's start with a song featuring one of the most familiar guitar riffs in all of rock and roll.
It's getting near dawn when lights close the tired eyes. I'll soon be with you, my love. Surprise.
On something like Sunshine of Your Love, which has this now really famous opening lick, do you consider that part of the composition, or is that something that was added afterwards, and who came up with that?
Well, that's Jack. We went to see Jimi Hendrix. Jimi was a dear friend of ours, and this was like 1967. There was a theatre in London called the Savile Theatre where everyone at the time was playing, and we went to see Jimi play there, and Jack and I were in a box looking down, and I think it was the first time Jack had really listened to Jimi properly, you know, and he was overwhelmed. And that night he went home and wrote that riff, and the song was actually written on the riff. It wasn't added, you know, it was the other way around from the way that you think. You know, we didn't add the riff to the song, we added the song to the riff.
You've said that you liked Jack Bruce's irreverence, that you liked him for not trying to be authentic, bluesman.
Yeah, he came in from another area altogether, and he was one of the first musicians that was, and Ginger too, but Jack, in a much more easily identifiable way, was a rebel, musical rebel. You know, he came from a jazz background, and it was he was like one of the first fusion players I'd ever met who was willing to cross jazz into blues and rock and roll all at the same time. He didn't see that there was a musical boundary. And he was a very intellectual, one of the first musical intellectuals that I met. He was deeply into classical music and modern classical music at that. And I was, for quite a while, under Jack's spell, because he seemed to me to have, you know, the most unique and avant-garde attitude towards music that I'd ever met.
What did Cream bring out in your playing that you hadn't expressed before?
Freedom, I think. I during the time that I was with Cream, I was constantly being urged by Jack and Ginger to kind of throw off all of my inhibitions that I'd spent years honing with the Blues Breakers, for instance, and my blues rule book was supposed to be going out the window, and it often did. You know, when we played live more than any other time, we would simply just improvise, and it would be very hard for me, more than anyone else, to really get rid of my idea of frameworks and structures. You know, I was really the last one to be able to let go of the things that I'd been using to hold me down up until then. With Cream, it came out of a very basic kind of necessity situation. The first gig we ever played at a big jazz festival in England, we ran out of material after about an hour, and the crowd wanted more, and they weren't going to give up, and so we literally had to go and jam, and we found that became the most popular part of our act, was when we didn't have anything set to play, and we would just play off the top of our heads. And it worked. A lot of the time, it really worked.
I'm wondering if there were times at concerts when everyone in the band was really high and nearly everybody in the audience was really high, and it would lead to this almost self-indulgent, you know, length in solos. Did you ever feel that way?
Yeah, I can remember playing at the Fillmore many times, at Fillmore West, when, you know, it was just like being in someone's front room with everyone smashed out of their brains listening to the stereo, and we were the stereo, really.
So was that a good feeling or an alienating feeling?
Well, I'm not going to pretend it was anything but great.
Okay,
I thought it was it was fantastic.
We'll be right back.
did the whole Clapton is God period have on you? What effect did it have on you when people were writing that kind of graffiti on walls?
Well, I don't think I actually ever saw it. You know, isn't that the funny thing? I don't think.
Is this all apocryphal? I mean, I can swear I've seen it.
I've only ever heard it said, and I've seen a picture of a wall in London, and it's a funny picture. There's this brick wall in London with "Clapton is God" written on it in white chalk or paint. I don't know what. And at the bottom of the picture, there's a dog peeing against the wall, you know? And that kind of sums up my attitude towards it. But I don't think I've ever actually seen it in the flesh. So it's all something that I've had to accept from other people. And as far as that goes, it's a bit like someone kind of paying you the highest compliment they can think of. And in that respect, I've tried to learn to accept it graciously.
Mm-hmm.
First of in the early days, I would just I was thoroughly disgusted with the whole thing, but as time has gone by, I've learnt to say thank you.
You can run, tell my friend Molly Brown. Run, you can run, tell my friend Molly Brown. And I'm standing at the crossroads, believe I'm sinking down.
Eric Clapton.
That was Cream, with Eric Clapton, Jack Bruce, and Ginger Baker playing Crossroads by Robert Johnson. Coincidentally, the late Robert Johnson is another Lifetime Achievement honoree at next week's Grammy Awards. Terry spoke with Eric Clapton in 1989. In a moment, we hear from one more Lifetime Achievement Grammy winner, David Bowie. This is Fresh Air. In addition to Merle Haggard, Cream, and Robert Johnson, another musician getting honored for Lifetime Achievement by the Grammy Awards is David Bowie. Bowie became an icon of glam rock after posing on the cover of his 1970 album, The Man Who Sold the World, wearing a gown and makeup. As rock critic Ken Tucker wrote in the Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, in the face of the hippie era's sincerity, intimacy, and generosity, Bowie presented irony, distance, and self-absorption. His song Changes announced the arrival of a new counterculture.
Still don't know what I was waiting for, and my time was running wild, a million dead-end streets, and every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me. I've never caught a glimpse how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Change it.
Turn and face the strain.
Change it.
Don't wanna be a richer man.
Bowie also is known for the changes in personalities he created to go with his various music. His best-known character, Ziggy Stardust, mixed androgyny and science fiction. He wore elaborate eye makeup and lipstick and dyed his hair a bright red. Bowie seemed to reinvent himself with successive albums, including Scary Monsters, Let's Dance, and Outside. Terry spoke to David Bowie in the summer of 2002. She asked him about his reputation for creating alter egos to go with his music.
I think much has been made of this alter ego business. I mean, I actually stopped creating characters in 1975, for albums anyway. The only time that I've adopted characterization again since that point for my own albums has been an album called Outside that I did with Brian Eno a few years ago, which really had a myriad maybe one too many characters, but it had a lot of characters on that, and I played all the parts. But that was done as a sonic theatrical piece of music. But the character thing really is sort of, for me personally, rather ancient history. But it's kind of, I guess over here specifically in America, the soundbitey thing really kind of stays around, and you're known by the... You're defined by the two or three things that the largest amount of people know about, and that kind of is who you are publicly. And mine is really Ziggy Stardust, characters, Let's Dance. That's me in the American, frankly, in the American eye. But in fact, in Europe, I'm more kind of this bloke what writes lots of stuff. And I guess a greater number of the 26 or so albums that I've made are known in Europe than they are in America.
How is your sense of yourself as a performer different now than it was when you were in your 20s and getting started and being... When you were in persona and doing the whole, you know, eye makeup and dyed hair and dresses,
yeah,
when you wanted
to. That was for 18 months, actually.
Right.
Which out of a career of nearly 40 years is not very long. However, I'll answer your question. I'm not actually a very keen performer. I like putting shows together. I like putting events together. In fact, everything I do is about the conceptualizing and realization of a piece of work, whether it's the recording or the performance side. And kind of when I put the thing together, I don't mind doing it for a few weeks, but then, quite frankly, I get incredibly bored because I don't see myself so much as a performer. I mean, I don't live for the stage. I don't live for an audience.
Can I stop you and say that I'm really surprised to hear that?
Most people are.
Yeah, because I always thought of you as somebody who really relished the theater aspect of performance and who very successfully made theater a part of music performance.
Frankly, if I could get away with not having to perform, I'd be very happy. It's not my favorite thing to do. As I say, I don't mind trying it out and making sure something seems to work well. But I really do rather want to move on, because I think it's rather a waste of time endlessly singing the same songs every night for a year. And it's just not what I want to do. What I like doing is writing and recording and much more on on that creative level. It's fun interpreting songs and all that, but I wouldn't like it as a living.
Did you grow up thinking of yourself as a singer, or did you start singing because you wanted to sing, you know, because you wanted to perform?
No, what I wanted to do when I was 9 years old, I wanted to be the baritone sax player in the Little Richard Band. I probably also wanted to be black at that particular time as well. So I got my father to help me out with a saxophone, and we bought it over like a 2-year period. We had something in Britain then called the hire purchase system, or HP, and I bought it on HP, which is like you pay 2 and 6 pence a week.
Oh, buying it on time.
Yeah, over like 1,000 years. So in the end, it cost you maybe twice as much as if you could have afforded cash.
Right.
And I started playing around with local rock bands, you know, with the alto, and then, in a nutshell, somebody fell ill one night, the lead singer in one of the bands, and they knew I could sing, so they asked me if I would stand up. And I quite enjoyed it, actually, I must say, at 14. It was a real trip, you know, to have girls wave at you and smile and everything, just because you opened your mouth and sang. I really wanted to do more than anything else, up until I was around 16, 17, was write musicals.
Was write music.
Musicals.
Oh, musicals.
I really wanted to write musicals. That's what I wanted to do more than anything else. Because I like rock music, I kind of moved into that sphere, somehow thinking that somewhere along the line I'd be able to put the two together. And I suppose I very nearly did with the Ziggy character, but I had such short attention span and got disinterested so quickly after I'd created some kind of project that I wanted to move on, and I never really got the book together for the thing. So I had all the songs and the characters. But by the time we'd gotten it on the road and I'd been doing it for 18 months, oh, God, I couldn't wait to move on to something else.
You were briefly in a mime group before
Yes, the Lindsay Kemp Mime Company.
Yeah, before becoming a solo musician.
Yeah.
Well, are there things that you learned or became aware of through the mime group that you said, yeah, that I really like that, I'm going to work with that in my own performances?
I think everything that I learned about stagecraft and carrying through, creating a through point for a theatrical device. I think Lindsay Kemp really introduced me to the work of Jean Genet, and through that, I kind of kept re-educating myself about other prose writers and poets. Mm-hmm. He opened an awful lot of doors for me in terms of a new approach to what I could do. I could never have done what I did without being involved with Lindsay Kemp's company.
Well, getting back to Ziggy, you know, the story of Ziggy Stardust is a story of someone who becomes very famous. It's the story of rock and roll fame. Becomes very famous, and then fame becomes his downfall. He's kind of killed in a way by fame. What did that fable that you created mean to you at the time? Is that the way you saw rock and roll?
Well, I can only really look at it the way I look at it now, which is, I think, independently of myself, Ziggy Stardust has his own life. He's his own creation, and you know what? Good luck to him. But frankly, for me, I kind of closed the door on him in 1973,
right.
And I'm very happy that he's having such success and that people still like him and all that. I heard he got married. Anyway, I personally have another life, you know, which doesn't belong to Ziggy Stardust, and I do tend to not really get that involved in what I've done in the past. I do kind of leave that up to other people, and that's much how I feel about Ziggy. I kind of prefer the audience and maybe writers or commentators or whatever, to make what they will of the Ziggy Stardust period and character, because it actually doesn't interest me much now.
Because rock and roll started as a youth music, everybody always wondered, well, will rock and roll continue to live? And what about the artists themselves? What about when they pass 30? What about when they pass 40 or when they pass 50? You're in your mid-50s now. Is that an issue for you? Do you feel like you have satisfactorily found a way to be a man in his mid-50s playing your music without feeling like what you're playing is, you know what I'm saying, that,
well,
that you're playing music that speaks to who you are and where you are now.
Having not really written any generational songs, I think maybe two or three of the songs that I've ever written have any bearing on the age of the listener. My stuff tends to be far more concerned with the spiritual and with subjects like isolation and being miserable. So I think that sort of touches on really any age group. So in my terms, they're just songs. The vehicle for those songs is a music that did indeed start as a youth culture music. But it is aged well in itself, and it has become a vast and complex thing now, with so many subdivisions and styles and variations. No, it's just what I do. I mean, I wouldn't know how to write and play any other kind of music, frankly.
David Bowie, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
David Bowie, speaking to Terry Gross in 2002. Next week, he'll receive a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Grammys.
Ziggy played guitar, jamming good with Webb and Gilly and the Spiders from Mars. He played it left hand, but made it too far. Became the special man, then we were Ziggy's band.
Coming up, a look at TV shows that left or are leaving before their time. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, TV critic for the New York Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. At this point in the show, I'd like to take a few minutes to talk about television and some shows that are on the air, off the air, going off the air, and long gone from the air. I want to talk about 24 and Lost, and The Book of Daniel and The West Wing, and Reunion and Threshold, and Wise Guy and Twin Peaks, and what they all have in common. They're all shows that break the once standard mold of primetime TV dramas, the rule that said each hour of every series could stand alone and be shown and enjoyed in almost any order, like cards shuffled in a deck. These other groundbreaking shows all promised longer, drawn-out episodic stories, more like daytime soap operas, but with finite mysteries to solve, from the murder of Laura Palmer or the alien invasion of the planet Earth to the election or murder of a president. It's an exciting, often very satisfying development, these complex methods of TV storytelling. Sometimes they get to tell and finish their tale in a way that makes it read like a complete novel. The Prisoner, starring Patrick McGoohan as a secret agent abducted to a mysterious island, pulled it off way back in 1968. Buffy the Vampire Slayer did it just a few years ago, and The Sopranos, which finally returns next month, is doing it now. The novel approach to TV is anything but novel, really. Masterpiece Theater has been doing it for 30 years, and is doing it brilliantly today with Bleak House, a terrific adaptation of the Charles Dickens novel. That novel, by the way, was written originally for newspapers the same way it's rolling out now on television, in weekly episodic installments. But with Bleak House, then and now, you can start the story comfortably reassured that eventually it will come to a natural conclusion. Get away from PBS and maybe HBO and Showtime, and that's not true. What's really infuriating about TV today is when one of these shows starts on its ambitious path and pulls you along, then doesn't get to finish. When the ratings go south, the shows are taken off the air, and viewers are left with a painful case of TV interruptus. I'm not talking about the unfunny sitcom Emily's Reasons Why Not being yanked off ABC after one episode. I'm not talking about a horrible reality show being jettisoned early, so we'll never know who won the ranch in The Will on CBS, or survived the world's most obnoxious boss on Fox. But I am talking about The Book of Daniel, which NBC, responding partly to advertiser dropout but mostly to low ratings, has pulled from the air after a handful of increasingly endearing episodes. For now, you can still watch new episodes of The Book of Daniel on Friday nights, but not on NBC. You can only see it if you go to NBC's website, where one of the last few shelved hours will be streamed each week. That's a far cry from broadcasting on an actual network, but it's a lot better than what's happened to Reunion on Fox or Threshold on CBS. Threshold, like Invasion on ABC and Surface on NBC, was one of this year's slowly unfolding sci-fi mysteries in the wake of last year's successful Lost. In my opinion, Threshold was the best of the three new shows. But not enough viewers agreed, so Threshold has been gone from CBS since November and isn't scheduled to reappear. What'll happen to those sneaky aliens trying to infect and overrun our planet? We'll never know. Similarly, there will be no webcast on Fox explaining who was the murderer on Reunion. Each episode in that show was supposed to take us forward in time 1 year, from 20 years ago to the present, and unmask the killer in the finale. Instead, all we're getting is a Fox executive's apology and the announcement that the killer probably was Sam's daughter. 5 years ago, when a different set of Fox executives unveiled a show called 24, with its unique real-time format, TV critics tried to extract from those executives a promise that if they started the series, it would definitely last all season. The executives refused. It's only because audiences warmed up to Kiefer Sutherland as Jack Bauer that we got to see his wife die at the end of the year, and all his bad days since. In the 1990s, Wise Guy hedged its bets by telling stories that spread over part of the season, what it called a story arc. Twin Peaks teased viewers too long before revealing Laura's killer, and ended up leaving with one of TV's most unresolved cliffhangers, Dale Cooper, possessed by the spirit of Bob. That should have taught us a lesson. But thanks to Lost being so successful and so good, we're all risking being left at the altar again with its many imitators. Or even worse, left just a few weeks into a TV romance. The West Wing will go out this May with a chance to finish its story at an opportune point, the peaceful transition of power from one presidential administration to another. For me, the show has been so good the last 18 months during this latest election cycle that it should have been renewed by NBC and allowed to follow its new chief executive into office. But not enough people are watching, so the West Wing is leaving. But at least it's ending and gets to go out with dignity. And at least I get to watch it on my TV set, not on my laptop. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bianculli.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Mary After All, a debut novel about one woman's struggle to find herself in Newark, New Jersey, by Bill Gordon. From the Susan and John Turbin Foundation for the NPR Fund for New Initiatives, helping to develop NPR's new programming and new media. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Jay McInerney on his new novel, The Good Life, which explores the life of a group of New Yorkers in the wake of the September 11th attacks. McInerney's other novels include Bright Lights, Big City and Brightness Falls. Join us for the next Fresh Air.